At a time when investors are confronted with market volatility and a variety of challenges fueled by the uncertainty of inflation, unsettled geopolitical tensions, and economic pressures, Justin Klein and Steve Peasley stand ready to take your finance and investment questions and share their unbiased answers. This is InvestTalk, independent thinking, shared success. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. The clarity for your path forward starts now. Here is KPP Chief Executive Officer, Financial Advisor, Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. This is our Monday, September 25th, 2023 edition. I'm Justin Klein, and I'm excited for this hour with you to help guide you through these challenging times. We have energy prices reasserting themselves to the upside, as well as interest rates. And the market has been a bit volatile the last couple of months. If you understand seasonality, that is to be expected. And this is a time where it's even more important to be focused on your long-term goals and your long-term strategy. Not get caught up in the minutiae of what's happened the last week or the last month. It's more about broader trends, medium to long-term trends, even though short-term there can be volatility. And so today is a day to refocus on the facts on the ground, not the narratives that you see that try to get you to click on something on the internet, whether that's social media or some other website. It's not about the narratives that the media wants to spin. You know, they always spin something around the markets. You know, markets were up because of X, Y, and Z. Oftentimes, the markets are up for very different reasons than some headline number. And so our goal here is to unpack the useful data and give you some unbiased perspective developed with over 20 years of investment experience. So we're going to talk about the market performance. We're going to run down some show topics, and we are going to get to callers. And we're going to do that right now and get to our first one at 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Steve and Justin. My name is Bijan. I'm listening for a few months. I had a quick question about jet ETF. Is it possible that airline ETF is going to see gains in the coming maybe year? Yeah, looking forward to your answer. Thank you for your time.
All right, looking at JETS, and this is the U.S. Global Jets ETF. And as you would imagine by the name, this is getting exposure to the airline industry. The top holdings are Southwest, Delta, United Airlines, Sun Country Airlines, SkyWest, Alaska Air, Hawaiian Airlines, Allegiant, and Air Canada. Those are the top 10 names and about 50 holdings overall, but 58% are in those top 10. So this is 58% of the assets, let's say, on the top 10. And this has rolled over pretty hard. It peaked around $22.50 in mid-July. Now we are at $17.10 at the close today, down 7 cents. And historically, airlines are not great businesses. They really aren't. Now, Southwest is probably the most consistent out of all of them. That's why it is the largest holding here in this particular ETF. But still, its return on equity is not that great. Remember, this is a highly capital-intensive business. Planes are worth millions and millions of dollars, and they tend to have a lot of them, so their fleet are worth billions. They have to pay gate fees to the airports, and it's cyclical business, meaning some people travel more, sometimes they travel less, depending on their excess savings. And then you also have the whims of the energy market, oil prices, and those are going up. And that's why this has rolled over, is that leg higher in oil prices, and that's going to weigh on profitability. That's one of the largest inputs into their operation, our energy prices. And then their workers, they're largely unionized. Think of the pilots union. And we're having strikes with UAW, the Hollywood writers, etc. And just historically, this is not a great business. Once again, Southwest is one of the best ones, and historically, its return on equity has been high single digits. Now it's at 5.4%. It's just not a great business to be in. And the technicals are now very poor. So I'm passing on Jets. I think there's much better opportunities out there in the marketplace. All right, now my focus point today looks in the story behind this headline. 10-year Treasury yields hit the highest level since 2007. This happened last week, and guess what? It happened again today, and we're going to touch on the economic data that may be driving that, as well as the broader implications of whether we might be near a peak in rates, at least near term. We also have some voice bank questions. One was regarding Nike and Roth IRAs. I want to touch a bit on oil prices and how, you know, we're approaching $100 a barrel again. But historically, it seems high. You know, it's a big round number, and everyone kind of uses that as a proxy. But when you look into the context of inflation-adjusted prices, as well as the energy intensiveness of our economy, especially when it comes to fossil fuels, it's not as jarring as it had been in the past. So we're going to look at some data there. Also, Western companies are now increasingly using the word de-risking from China as opposed to decoupling altogether. And we're going to talk about the strategies that they are taking to kind of wean themselves off of the supply chain being so dominated by China. Okay. And then lastly, we're going to touch on how entering the fourth quarter, there are growing headwinds to the economy and how much can the consumer withstand. And we're going to touch on what those major headwinds are. Also, a perspective today in regards to credit cards. When were they invented? What was the first modern credit card? And the perspective is coming up near the halfway point of the show. Now let's talk about the market as a whole today. It was a modest up day after a modest down day on Friday. You had the broad large caps up 0.4%, so 40 basis points. Small caps up 45 basis points, doing slightly better. And kind of a balance. Growth probably underperformed slightly, but nothing major on that front. You had the 10-year up about 10 basis points. That was really the big news overall. Up to 4.54% on the 10-year. The 30-year, that was up to 4.658%, up 14 basis points. So you're seeing those longer duration assets selling off in a bigger way. And that usually feeds into equity multiples. So I wanted to, you know, the market is still digesting the hawkish rhetoric that's coming out of the Fed, but you also have some economic data, the PCE number, and I believe, what was the other one? There's another major one I'll talk about later in the show that is going to feed into what happens with interest rates and the broader economy. So that was the market today, modest update overall. All right, we're going to a break. Let me remind you, the new Invest.Classroom series, and it's episode 7. It's on cryptocurrency, and we do a deep dive on that. It's a complex subject, but we all know that some bad actors have hijacked the industry. And so where are the risks? Where are the opportunities? And we discuss that more in our Invest.Classroom series on our YouTube channel. So head over there and check it out. Now, my phone lines are open waiting for your questions at 888-99-CHART.
Justin Klein talks about the KPP Financial Premium Newsletter.
I want to remind you that this is a time where you probably need some guidance and you're tuning in to try to get our view of the markets. And we only have an hour here. And sometimes the way I distill each day can be maybe not enough time. And so our premium newsletter is a great tool for especially newer investors trying to learn some things.
The KPP Financial Premium Newsletter comes to your mailbox every Saturday.
Learn how to analyze the market, learn what the economic numbers mean, learn how to manage a portfolio, maybe get an idea of what are good companies to be at least looking at. Maybe you don't buy it today, but you should always have a watch list of companies that, hey, these are interesting. These have good businesses. And if they get the right price, maybe I should buy them. So our newsletter is a great tool for that.
Subscribe anytime at investtalk.com. Everybody wants a secure financial future, but getting there takes strategy, discipline, and the right information. That means you'll have finance and investment questions. Justin Klein is ready to provide his unbiased answers. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Now, my main focus point today looks in the story behind this headline. The 10-year Treasury yield is at its highest level since 2007, and that was on the back of Moody's, the ratings agency, that said today that a government shutdown will be credit negative for the country as a whole. So obviously that adds to the level of worry within the bond market of how the U.S. government debt level, as well as inflation, and now credit, I guess just simply credit rating, are becoming more and more questionable. You know, it used to be, hey, we had a vibrant economy, inflation was relatively in check, you know, I'm thinking pre-pandemic levels, and the U.S. government, while not as great as it had been 30 years ago, was still on solid footing. And that's starting to slip a bit. And so it's not one thing, I think, that is worrying the bond market. It's a confluence of factors. And then you add on top of that, the Fed saying we're going to likely remain higher for longer. Before the Fed meeting last week, there was an expectation of 4 rate cuts next year. And that has been downgraded to 2. So obviously higher for longer means those longer dated securities are going to sell off. Now, a government shutdown could happen basically by Sunday. That's October 1st. And little progress was made over the weekend. And that's the big issue. And what's interesting is that one side's not blaming the other at this point. The Republicans are blaming themselves. Right, Matt Gaetz came out and said, hey, this is the Republicans' problem. We didn't pass the bill. And so what you're seeing is the extremes, there's extremes on both sides of the aisle. And both, in many instances, depending on the topic, are willing to kind of hold the more centrist part of whatever wing they're working with kind of hostage. And that's what you're seeing now. And that makes getting things done a bit harder. And that's the political situation that we are dealing with today. Now, we also have some economic data coming in from the housing sector. We also have the Fed's favorite inflation gauge, which is the Personal Consumer Expenditure Price Index, the PCE index. So what the core number will come in at will certainly be watched by the Fed. Remember, that's Friday. So you may not get a whole lot of fireworks coming up for the rest of the week. Although tomorrow, let's see what the calendar looks like for the rest of the week. Tomorrow, you do have that new home sales number, single family home sales. You have the Fed, Richmond Fed Manufacturing Index. That'll be interesting to see how that comes in. And then Wednesday, you have durable goods orders. So how willing are consumers to go out and spend on big ticket items, things that last over a year, not just food and clothing, but, you know, big ticket items, new furniture, new appliances, new cars. And then Thursday, we have initial jobless claims once again. That'll be interesting as that hit the lowest level since January last week. You have the real GDP number quarter over quarter. Now that's for the second quarter. It's kind of pointless because it's so backwards looking, but it will be talked about. Then we have pending home sales. So current existing homes, that'll be big as well. You have total vehicle sales coming out on Thursday. And then once again, Friday is that PCE number, and that will be watched as well as consumer sentiment. So big after last week was, although we had the Fed meeting, was a light week for economic data. This will be a very, very busy week for economic data. We'll know a lot more about where the economy is headed going into the fourth quarter by the end of the month and end of the quarter and end of the week. So very interesting to see how that plays out. Now we're going to a quick break. Please remember that you can call anytime, leave your questions on the InvestTalk Voice Bank, or if you're listening via the live stream or on AM 1220 radio in the Silicon Valley area, you can call right now at 888-99-CHART.
Justin Klein and Steve Beasley are ready to take on your finance and investment questions. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go talk to Dan in Walnut Creek. Wants to talk about precious metals.
Hi, Justin.
How you doing? You want to talk about precious metals?
Yes, I do. Thanks. So I think you said in last week's show that silver had finished the day higher than gold, and that was a good thing for precious metals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you said. And I was wondering if this is a if I should still be hanging on to my precious metal mining stocks.
Well, if you look at the gold prices and precious metal prices in general, they peaked back in May, and that a lot of that had to do with the kind of higher for longer narrative started to pick up then, and the dollar started to really reverse. You know, there was this belief that going into this year, due to the rapid rise in rates, that the economy would weaken so much that the Fed would start to embark on a cutting cycle. And obviously that has been pushed off into next year for various reasons. A lot of it has to do with fiscal really domination that's allowing us to have a huge deficit, but that's a lot of money going out there. Now, what's interesting here is you've got a lot of headwinds over the past 4 or 5 months now. Higher dollar, higher interest rates, and typically would break gold to the downside in a big way, but we still remain kind of around that 1900 level on gold. And the silver to gold ratio, which is what I was speaking to, is typically silver will outperform in a time when precious metals are doing well. And so, because it's just simply a more volatile metal. And so what you've seen over the past really year, it's kind of gone, that ratio has kind of gone sideways. It's not breaking down. It's not breaking out. It tried to break out back in late August. That failed a bit. It tried to break down in mid-September. That also reversed. So we still remain kind of in this zone here. And which way that breaks, I think, will be a big tell on which way precious metals will break. But, you know, talk about the economy likely going into recession sometime early next year. And that will finally be the time, I think, where the expectation for the Fed cutting will accelerate. And as opposed to right now, it keeps kind of being pushed off. And once again, the fact that it's not breaking down in that environment is a fairly bullish tell for me. And, you know, it just remains from a pattern perspective in a consolidation range. And now that could change. You always have to watch that. But so far, it's holding up fairly well considering the hawkish narrative that kind of continues to slowly build. But we know once there's a clear break in the economy, that will shift. And I think that's when you're going to get that next leg higher in metals. And I do think that happens probably by year end. But until then, until you get that clear narrative that the economy is breaking and interest rates are that the unemployment rate is actually now in an uptrend as opposed to in a downtrend, that's when you'll see gold take off. So we're still holders of them. I think you'll get another rally, like I said, into next year. And I think next year will be a great year for that space. All right. Thanks for the call. Now, let's pivot over to oil. And oil is approaching $100 a barrel again. And this rise in energy prices is certainly going to feed into a lot of parts of the economy. You know, the cost of fertilizer, for example, goes up when natural gas prices go up. That hasn't really been happening in a big way. But once the food is grown, it needs to get to the store. And guess what? That takes trucks, and trucks use diesel. Then you have jet fuel demand. It is increasing, and that means higher prices for jet fuel, or sorry, for airline tickets. And then you have the input costs to things like asphalt and plastics. Now, that will broadly feed into inflation. Now, the Fed typically excludes food and energy itself, but once again, those things feed in to other aspects of the economy. And now investors and economists compare the current moment to previous periods. And it said, you know, many times higher oil prices actually tip the economy into a recession. And it's not just about the exact price, it's the acceleration in price over a short period of time. Now, so far, gas is up 25% since the start of the year after being obviously down last year. And economists are fearing that this will push people to spend less on restaurants, travel, etc. And that's to be expected. That's in a lot of ways, higher energy prices is deflationary in the medium term. Short term, it's inflationary, but medium term, it tends to be deflationary because of diverting dollars to the bare necessities, which is energy prices. Now, inflation-adjusted prices are similarly higher than today's levels back in 1979, 1981. And gas actually peaked the highest level in 2008, June 2008, at $5.71 per gallon. Now we're at $3.88. So oil's been much higher in the past, and so it's definitely a worry, but it's not to a level that is in and of itself going to push us into a recession. But certainly, with other things, could get us there. All right, now in the next Invest Talk, we're looking at the story behind this question. Why do bond yields keep rising? That story tomorrow, but for now, I'm ready to take your calls at 888-99-CHART.
Meet Charlie. She loves dogs.
Guilty.
She powers her pup empire with Shopify.
The sales won't stop.
With Charlie's tech needs sorted, she can focus on turning her home business into a global operation. Yes, boy. Join Shopify, the commerce platform powering millions of businesses worldwide. This is Possibility, powered by Shopify. Sign up for a free trial at shopify.co.uk/green. Go to shopify.co.uk/green to start selling online today.
You're building your financial future, but you must have finance and investment questions. Justin Klein and Steve Peasley are ready to provide their unbiased answers. So don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Hey, Steve or Justin, this is Rohan from San Francisco. I had a quick question about the stock Nike, N-K-E. I have been looking at this stock for quite some time. It's been on my watch list, and it's come to a point where I'm looking to buy to start a position. I'm looking for a long-term, you know, 3 to 5 years play. $90 is around where I want to buy it, and so I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on that stock and, you know, what are the near-term or long-term outlook for it, and then what are the good entry points. Your opinion. Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. I believe I had a call last week about Nike, and I'll give you the same sentiments, which is you have a CFO. This is one of the biggest red flags that I see in decisions to who's becoming CEO or COO. And if you ever have a CFO elevate to the level of CEO or COO, I see that as a problem. I typically see that as a problem because they look at the company through the lens of simply the balance sheet, simply efficiency. And a lot of times that can be very good in the short term. But long term, there's typically means that they're taking their eye off of qualitative considerations. And everything is turned into quantitative. And we know there's a balance. There's a balance. For example, marketing. You invest in marketing, you don't know exactly what the payoff will be, what the exact ROI is. Now, sometimes you do, especially with online marketing. But for example, big spending on giant campaigns, changing the look and feel of marketing, the direction of marketing in general. Doing things that make consumers wonder and get excited about a particular brand. Oftentimes, a CFO is going to quash that because it doesn't have clear numbers behind it that play out in the near term. Often those are long-term payoffs. And so I think that's what's happening here at Nike. They're not innovating. You have the problems in China that are manifesting in lower sales and simply headwinds there. And the former CFO is now the COO. So my issue is, what is the catalyst that's going to drive this company back up? They made a bunch of money during the pandemic. People had money and they spent on physical goods. And people love Nikes. They love Air Force Ones and Jordans. Even the Blazers that were invented in, I believe, the 70s. Those are hot now. But what's the last Nike shoe that anyone can remember that was brand new and super exciting that everybody loved? I don't know. Our latest LeBrons. Yeah, I play basketball, so I see all the new shoes that come out. I wear the LeBron 20s, so when I play. And they're good shoes. They're very good shoes. They're probably one of the best shoes that they've made since some of the Kobes. But it's not really moving the needle. And then you have competitors like On Running and Hoka. Those are two that are growing a lot better and taking some of the market share in the casual and the running side of the business. So I just see there's a lot of headwinds here. Technicals are very poor and it's still trading at a pretty elevated multiple. Talking about high 20s multiple for something whose earnings are negative 27% year over year last quarter. Revenues were only at 5%. I think it's headed lower. 75 is my number. That's where it starts getting interesting. But until then, I'm passing on Nike. All right, let's go to Brian in Charlotte. Wants to talk about MLPs.
Justin.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. I've recently become in charge of my elderly mother's portfolio, mm-hmm. and it's a heavily income-based portfolio. Mm-hmm. My question was, what is your thoughts on MLPs, the master limited partnership, that side of income producing, and maybe if I can give you a particular stock, I'd really like your opinion on it.
Sure. Let's hear that one stock, and then I'll give you a broad overview of the space.
Great. Thanks. That would be ticker symbol EPD, Enterprise mm-hmm. Product Partners.
Yeah. This is I believe now one of the largest or the largest MLP that's still out there. Some of them have there were some tax law changes a couple of years ago. I believe it was during the Trump tax cuts that changed how MLPs were taxed, and some of them no longer became MLPs. And I think EPD is still one of the largest, and it's solid. It's good. I have no problem with it in and of itself. Now, let me ask you this. Are these accounts that are they're tax deferred, or are they taxable accounts? Meaning, are they IRAs or Roth IRAs, or are these taxable accounts?
This is in a rollover IRA, so I believe it's a tax deferred account.
Okay, so in an IRA, and if you earn over, I believe it's $1,000 in income from limited partnerships in a particular year, you're going to get a K-1. So it's going to definitely complicate the tax situation for you. I think you said it was your mother, right?
Yeah, she's 80. So yeah. You know.
So and she now she's probably, I'm guessing, in a low tax bracket, correct?
Well, she does generate quite a bit from her investments.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say low, but she's not obviously making tremendous amounts of money.
Yeah. So here's the issue here is that she's going to get a K-1. You have to file separate reports or separate tax returns for these. And that income is going to be taxed at her ordinary income tax rate. So it's not privileged in any way. It's not like your normal income that you're getting from your Procter & Gamble's of the world, right? Your qualified dividends. Okay. These dividends are not qualified. So that's why we don't love them, because of the tax complexity. And especially in an IRA, now you have taxable income, whereas before this is tax sheltered, right? She doesn't have to pay income if it was qualified. Right. So it's up to you whether you want to deal with the tax implications, but you just have to know about them and be aware of them and come to a decision there. You get a nice 7.3% yield, but once again, you have to pay taxes on that. If she's in a 30% tax bracket, that looks more like 5%, right?
Right.
Which is nice, but you can get 5% elsewhere in qualified companies. And you know, like we own some of the similar type of companies, the ones that are engaged in the same activity, gathering and processing of natural gas and oils and transporting them. And they pay lower dividends, but they're qualified dividends. So I would probably sell EPDs and the other MLPs in your portfolio and look for the ones that have qualified dividends, maybe not quite as high, but then you don't have to deal with the tax consequences of that, and it's all tax deferred.
It makes tremendous sense. Thank you, by the way. Thank you for you and Steve for simplifying things. I've been listening for about 6 months, and y'all helped out a tremendous amount.
No problem, Brian. Thanks for calling, and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Our now perspective today looks into the history of credit cards, when they were invented, what was the first modern credit card, and what is our reliance on them today. Now, for a lot of people, credit card usage is second nature. We've gotten used to them. They're all around us, and you may be wondering, when were credit cards invented? Now, let's go all the way back to the 1700s, and people were taking part in transactions that resembled credit cards. Now, back then, it was a credit transaction between merchants and farmers. There were several months between planting and harvesting crops, and farmers would often receive seeds from merchants by promising to pay the merchant back after harvesting the crops. So that was kind of the first, I guess you'd call it credit card, just credit between two corporations. Now, the middle of the 20th century, the first bank card was not a credit card per se, but it was an instrument of pre-arranged credit for customers of a certain New York bank called Charge It. That's what it was called back then. This was 1946, and people in the account at the bank could use the card at a few select merchants. And the merchants would send the receipt to the bank, and the bank would pay them for the items purchased and later the bill sent to consumers. So it was a credit card, but you can only use them at just a handful of places. And obviously there was no credit card network. It was a relationship between the bank and the merchant. In the 1950s, history recorded the birth of the Diners Club card. Most people know that was the first modern-day credit card, and it was first used only in local restaurants and then expanded to additional retailers more broadly. Now, the new charge card required customers to pay the balance in full at the end of every month. By 1951, the Diners Club boasted 42,000 members and expanded to all major U.S. cities. By 1953, it was accepted in Canada, Cuba, Mexico, and the United Kingdom. And then the concepts evolved. Banks began issuing their own credit cards. And instead of requiring full payment at the end of the month, there was revolving credit. Now, American Express launched in 1958, and it made its name by transporting customers' valuables and offering traveler's checks. Now, the Bank America card, Bank America card, was launched by Bank of America. It was the first consumer credit card, and that was in 1958. And it was the first to offer revolving credit. Now, 1966, MasterCard was a network of banks that accepted cards as payment from formed the Interbank Card Association. Originally named MasterCharge, by the 1970s, it became the global alliance called MasterCard International. Discover was launched in 1986. It was initially launched by Sears, Robux, and Company. It had no annual fee. And one of the first cash back rewards programs. Think about that. The cash back rewards program is less than 40 years old. And in 2008, Discover actually acquired Diners Club. Now, as of today, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York Center for Microeconomic Data issued its quarterly report on household debt and credit. We had a slight uptick in total household debt in the second quarter. Increased by $16 billion to $17 trillion. Credit card balances increased $45 billion to $986 billion. And we recently reached over $1 trillion at the end of the second quarter. Now, a lot of people will say, oh, we're at $1 trillion. That's a problem. If you understand history, you know that higher credit card balances mean more consumer spending, means more at least near-term economic data or economic momentum. Now, aggregate limits on credit card accounts increased $9 billion and now stands at $4.6 trillion. But delinquency rates remain roughly flat year over year. And so there's not a huge increase in delinquencies or any problem like that, mainly because people are employed. When you have a job, you tend to pay at least the minimum balance. Now, the average interest rate for all credit cards accounts hit 20.68% in May, the highest on record. And no matter how you look at it, there's been a giant change in the credit card industry in just 70 years. Now, let's swing back to the InvestTalk Voice Bank for a call that came in earlier at 888-99-CHART.
Hello, guys. I have a question. For a Roth IRA, I know after the 5 years of having the account open, you can go ahead and withdraw your actual investment. But I was wondering, if you have dividend stocks within that profile, when you receive those dividends after 5 years, can you also withdraw those? Thank you.
No, the dividends are considered gains on the investment. All investments have two return components that you can have, capital gains or income of some sort. And so it's just considered part of that return profile. Just because it's income doesn't mean that it changes anything. Remember, most of the returns that come from equities actually come from income, from those dividends. So yeah, don't think that that changes how much you can take out of your Roth IRA. All right, this is Invest Talk. I'm Justin Klein. We have one goal each and every weekday, and that's to help you achieve your own version of financial freedom. And our work continues after this final break. So get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Each day, InvestTalk listeners submit their finance and investment questions via phone or email. Would you like your question to be put near the top of the list? Just take a minute or two to leave a review and rating for InvestTalk at iTunes. And be sure to include a brief question with your iTunes review comments.
Hey, Dan from New York, calling back from last week talking about GDX and GDXJ. But just curious your take on another ask regarding uranium, specifically the URA ETF. Wondering if just, you know, secular tailwinds are making it a good buy at this time, green energy and that kind of push, or what your long-term outlook is there. Appreciate all the help and advice over the years, but yeah, looking forward to the answer on the show. Thanks. Bye.
Well, I've been talking about uranium for at least 2 years, about how it's probably one of the best places to invest in the market, simply because if you're pushing towards clean energy alternatives to fossil fuels, uranium is by far the best place to be. It's economical. It just takes a bit of investment in scaling the production of nuclear facilities, and it takes the public to get over the fear-mongering by a lot of environmental agencies throughout the years. And there's a lot of plants that have been shut down throughout the world, and with the higher cost of energy, well, fossil fuels, they've been reopening them, and then China's opening dozens and dozens of them because they see the health havoc that their coal factories have put on their population, or have inflicted on their population. And so the demand for uranium is only going to go up. And I think it was the EU who recently classified nuclear as green. And if you actually understand the science, there's really no way to get to climate goals in a reasonable amount of time without drastically developing and investing in a nuclear fleet. It's not going to work if you're just putting up solar panels and wind farms. And most hydroelectric dams have been put up in anywhere that they can be put up without creating major environmental damage. So nuclear is clearly the way to go, and the trends within society are pushing that way. And post-Fukushima, there were a lot of plants or mining facilities that were shut down. And so now you have a deficit. And uranium is just taking off. It's finally breaking out, and I think there's a long way to go. Now, it's a bit overbought right now, so you might get more of a pullback at some point, and then by year end. But to me, that's a pullback to buy. So yeah, as I've been saying for 2+ years, uranium is a great place to be. All right, let's touch a bit lastly on how Western companies are trying to de-risk from China. And they're not using the word decoupling anymore, because it's not about getting out of China completely. But what a lot of companies are starting to do is make their China operation service China, meaning, hey, we have Chinese production and we have a lot of Chinese demand. Let's just have those operations fuel the demand within China. And longer term, companies are pushing to invest elsewhere. A report that by the European Chamber of Commerce found that 11% of European businesses surveyed had already relocated investment out of China, while 22% had decided or were considering such a shift. And the first time since 2016, less than half of respondents plan to expand their operation within China this year. And here in America, the American Chamber of Commerce found that 12% of U.S. groups surveyed were considering relocating their sourcing outside of China, with another 12% already doing so. Now, the issue is that a lot of companies don't have alternatives to China, so it's going to take a while for companies to build out that production. But clearly, the plans are moving this way. And what a lot of companies are doing are what we call China plus one. They're keeping their China production, but diversifying it out of the country, additional investment. And that's why China's economy is slowing so dramatically, because the foreign direct investment is slowing to a trickle. And their economy is reliant on investment, both internally and externally. So that's the trends you're seeing, and that's it's going to take a while, but I don't think it's going anywhere. All right, I'm Justin Klein. This completes another Invest Talk program. Steve Peasley and I thank you for listening, and we encourage you to tell your friends and family about our free podcast downloads, which you can find anytime at iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play, and be sure to rate and review on iTunes as well. And we have now achieved more than 55.8 million downloads since it all began. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
InvestTalk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Steve Peasley is president, and Justin Klein is chief executive officer of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.